last time I taught this, well, they always have a cap on it, like 75 or something like this, but I don't know if anyone's ever signed, that many has ever signed up. I think it was 19 last time, too, but they put me in Kiva. And so it was me on this huge stage and all 19 people in the back row. So it was a similar situation here, remember? All right, so let's talk about the endocrine system. The endocrine system is one of two control systems in the body. All right, what's the other control system? Well, what is a control system? A system that controls the other systems, right? So what two systems do that? Yeah, the nervous system and the endocrine system are the body's two control systems. This is why you have such exquisite control that's being exercised over your various functions, because you have two systems dedicated to doing that. And making it even more exquisite is the fact that each of these two control systems controls the other, at least partially. So the endocrine system exercises control over the nervous system and vice versa. Well, the nervous system we studied in 201. In fact, that was half of the term. We was studying the nervous system in one way or another. Now we're talking about the other. And there are similarities and differences, of course. One similarity is that both control systems operate on the basis of signals. Signals get sent somewhere and result in changes. In other words, different things happen that wouldn't happen if those signals weren't present. Or things stop happening because of the presence of signals, whatever the case may be. There's a difference, though, in the nature of those signals. What are the signals that the nervous system uses? Everyone hear that? Of course not. It was too quiet and you're too far spaced out. What was your guess? There are electrical signals that are used. More correctly, I would call them electrochemical signals. What are the electrochemical signals that the nervous system uses? What do we call those things? What are you saying? You're still mumbling. Speak to the whole class.
Neurotransmitters.
Not yet. Those aren't electrochemical signals. Right. Action potentials are electrochemical signals. Right. Action potential propagation is not an action potential traveling down a neuron. Right. That's not what happens. Instead, an action potential occurs in one little slice of the neuron, and that action potential causes an action potential right next to it, and so on down the line. It's a chain reaction. So action potential propagation refers to action potentials causing subsequent action potentials all the way down the length of the axon. And those are electrochemical because it's partly electrical, partly chemical. It's electrical because what types of things are moving through the membrane during action potentials? Think back to about 4 weeks ago. Ions, right. Ions in general, not just cations necessarily, but well, for action potentials, it's cations, correct. But ions is what I was looking for here. Ions are charged particles, right? Therefore, they carry electrical charge, and when you move them around, you are redistributing electrical charge. That's what a potential is, right? A potential is a gradient of electrical charge. But it's also chemical because you're moving the entire ion. You're not just moving electrons around, which is what happens in a wire, electrical wire. You're moving entire ions, with their electrons associated with the nucleus. So action potentials are electrochemical, but what's the end result of an action potential? What good does an action potential do? The action potential isn't what tells a target tissue to do something. This is review, by the way. What happens at the end of an axon? Right. The release of a neurotransmitter is the ultimate direct effect of an action potential, right? The action potential itself is a voltage. That voltage change opens up voltage-gated calcium ion channels. The influx of calcium ions causes the exocytotic release of neurotransmitter. Right? So that's what happens at the end of the axon. Well, that neurotransmitter is a chemical signal. It's a chemical that's being released that wouldn't be released if it weren't for the excitation of that neuron. So in response to some event, a chemical signal is released. That's what happens in the endocrine system as well. Chemical signals are the types of signals that the endocrine system operates on. Only chemical signals. Whereas the nervous system uses electrochemical and chemical signals. But as I said before, the nervous system and endocrine system operate on each other. So some of the endocrine organs release their chemical signals in response to innervation by the nervous system. Okay? Now, there is another important distinction I want to make between the types of signals. Actually, I think I have a slide for that, so I'll keep that at bay for now. It's better if I can show you a picture while I'm doing this. Let's look at slide one, though. We'll get back to comparing the endocrine and nervous system in a little bit. But this is an overview of the gross anatomy of the endocrine system. These are the major organs involved. And endocrine organs are glands. They're glands that release these chemical signals I'm talking about. And many of them are major organs, like you see the ones listed here. Pineal gland, hypothalamus, pituitary, adrenal glands, the gonads, whether it's male or female gonads, ovaries or testes, and so on. In other words, some of these are well-formed, conspicuous, complex organs. But there are all kinds of tiny, microscopic endocrine organs that are really just tissue embedded in organs of other systems, that they are officially part of the endocrine system as well because they release these signals. Okay? So when you think of the organs that make up any given organ system, you shouldn't think that they have to be members of only that system. There's overlap. For instance, the heart is part of the circulatory system, but it can also be considered an endocrine organ because it releases its own signals. Similarly for the kidneys, part of the urinary system and part of the endocrine system, and so on. So these are the major organs that are actually big in size and that we're going to mostly pay attention to. And we're going to have particular attention paid to what's happening up here in the head. The hypothalamus, which is, of course, part of the brain, as you learned before, has an intimate relationship with the pituitary gland, which is called the pituitary gland, but is actually only partially a gland. And really, what we call the pituitary gland is two different structures that just happen to grow together when they develop. But those two pieces are distinct in how they develop and from what they develop, and they remain distinct throughout life. They just look like one piece to us, which is why we call it the pituitary gland. There's only really one part of it, though, that's glandular. All right, let's go to 2. And as you know, I typically don't read tables to you, but I kind of want to read this one, at least mostly to you. This is the comparison of the nervous and endocrine system, like we've already started talking about. So, electrical impulses and neurotransmitters. That's just another way of saying that the nervous system operates by electrochemical and chemical means, whereas the endocrine system communicates by means of hormones. Well, hormones are the actual chemical signals. All right, now, the chemical signals in the nervous system are neurotransmitters, or neuromodulators, which are really just neurotransmitters that are doing a slightly different job. Those words, neurotransmitter, neuromodulator, and hormone, and in fact there are such things as neurohormones, those words are all functional distinctions. They are not structural distinctions. What I mean by that is calling something a hormone or a neurotransmitter or any of the other two words doesn't tell you at all the chemical nature of that signal. It just tells you how it operates. And in fact, the exact same chemical can be a neurotransmitter in one instance if it's released by a neuron, or a hormone if it's released by an endocrine organ. Okay, so what we call it is based on how it operates. And how it operates has an important spatial distinction. Neurotransmitters and neuromodulators are nervous signals released by axon terminals that work locally. They travel a very short distance just by diffusion once they're released exocytotically by the vesicles. They just have to diffuse across the synaptic cleft to whatever that postsynaptic cell is, whether it's another neuron or anything else. In other words, by locally, what I mean is that neurotransmitters and neuromodulators are not broadcast through the body by entering the bloodstream. They just stay in the extracellular fluid, and they have their effect, and then they are quickly taken back up so that they don't continue to have their effect unnaturally long. Remember when we talked about acetylcholinesterase, the enzyme that's responsible for breaking acetylcholine down so that it no longer causes the muscle to contract? Well, that's what I mean by a local effect. Very pinpoint accuracy on how these things operate. Hormones are just the opposite. They have a global function. And that's because they are broadcast throughout the body. By broadcast, I mean they're sent everywhere. Just like the light rays, the light waves that we call radio waves. All right? That transmitter is sending that throughout the city. So those light waves are passing through my body right now, those radio waves. But I'm not playing any music, right? Or I'm not sensing any music. So those radio waves aren't having any effect on me because there's no interaction between those light waves and my body. Similarly, a hormone, when it's broadcast throughout the body by being put into the bloodstream and being carried away by the blood, and blood goes almost everywhere in the body, only certain organs are going to even know that that signal is present, even though all of the tissues of the body get exposed to it. Just like the only things that are going to be able to play music are receivers of those radio waves, the only tissues in the body that are going to have any change occur in response to a broadcast hormone released somewhere in the body is if that tissue has the right kind of receptor for that specific hormone. We talked about this in 201, right? Chemical signals have no effect unless there is a binding between the signal and a receptor. And this is why endocrine organs can send the same signal everywhere to the body, but only certain things respond. Not only that, but you can have the same signal cause different effects in different organs based on what happens after that binding event that occurs between the receptor and the hormone. And what is the hormone acting as in this case, in the general sense? If it binds to a receptor, what is a hormone an example of? A ligand, right. Ligands are things that are ligated or tied to something else. In this case, they're tied to or temporarily bound to a receptor. Well, what are receptors, molecularly speaking? They are proteins, yes. Proteins are ideally suited among the types of macromolecules that cells are made of. Proteins are ideally suited to being receptor molecules. Why is that? Compared to the other types of macromolecules, which are what? There's four classes of macromolecules in biology. What are they? I already gave you one. You can give me that one, first one, if you want to participate. Well, that's not the one I gave you. Proteins is one. Not nucleotides. That's not a macromolecule. Nucleic acids, otherwise known as polynucleotides. What else? Polysaccharides. And lipids. Yeah. Of those four, proteins are much better suited than the other three for serving as receptors. Why is that? What is special about proteins? Well, think about three of these four. Three of these four macromolecular classes are officially polymers. Which one is not? Which of the four that we mentioned is not really a polymer? Nucleic acids are polymers. They are polynucleotides. Lipids are not, correct. So the three polymers are polynucleotides, nucleic acids, polypeptides, proteins, and polysaccharides. So each of those are polymers because they're built by stringing together monomers. All right? What are the monomers of polysaccharides? Monosaccharides. And even though there are plenty of different kinds of monosaccharides, when you build a polysaccharide, or when a cell does, usually it's using the same monosaccharide over and over, like starch, for instance, or cellulose. Those are both made out of nothing but glucose, just a hell of a lot of them strung together. Polynucleotides, what are the monomers? Nucleotides. Of which there are how many? There are five if you count RNA and DNA both. But for one of the two, there's four, right? Four kinds in RNA, four kinds in DNA. Proteins, though, that have what is their monomers? Amino acids. And how many are they? There are 20 biological amino acids, 20 that cells use. As many more as you want to build in a laboratory, but 20 that organisms use. And so when you get to making a polypeptide versus the other two polymers, there's a lot more possibilities, right? Because you have 20 different kinds of beads to work with rather than just one or just four. And what this means when you finally end up making that protein is that because of that variety, there can be just about any shape you want if you were designing the thing. Proteins can take on just about any shape if you have the right sequence of amino acids. And remember, I said that proteins, no matter what, which of the many important jobs that they perform in cells, whether it's being a structural protein, a signal receptor, an enzyme, whatever it's doing, that protein has that specific job because of what? It's able to perform its function because of what? Because of its shape. So, to be a receptor, a specific receptor, that is only going to respond to a specific kind of hormone or chemical signal, that receptor has to have a very specific shape. And proteins can have very specific shapes. That's why they work as antibodies, for instance, and recognize just a specific kind of antigen because of the nice hand-in-glove arrangement of their shapes. Okay, so this is why broadcasting throughout the body doesn't mean all the tissues are going to be affected. All the tissues will be affected if all the tissues happen to have receptors for that particular signal. For instance, thyroid hormone kind of is like that. Just about all the tissues respond to it. But there are plenty of hormones that are very specific and won't have any effect at all except in a very couple places. Oxytocin, for instance, doesn't affect most of the body. But it affects the uterus, causes uterine contraction, part of parturition, a positive feedback mechanism, and so on. And the reason that is because the uterus has the receptors, the other tissues do not. So that's the basis. I mean, that's part of why you also have this local effect for neurotransmitters and global effect for hormones. Notice there's also a difference in with respect to the timing of things. Neurotransmitters are not only very locally specific, but they operate like that, right? Doesn't take very long at all for diffusion to happen if it's happening over a very short distance. And a synaptic cleft is a tiny distance. If you had to rely on diffusion to get a molecule from your toe to your head, it would take weeks or months, or maybe even years. So diffusion works very well, but only over short distances. The blood, that's why you have blood, by the way. That's why you have to have a circulatory system, because diffusion can't do the job of moving things around over such huge distances. You need to convect the fluid, which is what blood does. It convects throughout the body. Well, not only does this take, you know, with respect to the, compared to the time in which a neurotransmitter does its job, it takes much longer just for the hormone to reach the tissues because it's riding around in the blood. But then even after that happens and it binds to a receptor, it can take quite a long time for the effect to actually be realized because there's a lot of steps in between the reception of that hormone at its receptor and the ultimate effect. The fact that there's many steps is going to be important, by the way, and we'll talk about why that's important. So quick to start and quick to stop when it comes to neural signals, but endocrine signals take a little time for them to work, and they continue to work for a while. They don't just shut off immediately. And then the final one has to do with adaptation. To adapt to a stimulus means to basically get sick of responding. To adapt means you say, okay, I realize the signal is there, now I'm going to just ignore it. Well, you have quick adaptation to continual stimulation in the nervous system. Not so quick in the endocrine system. So those are important differences, but there are some similarities built in there as well. Now that we're on slide 3, we can see a picture of what I was trying to describe as being broadcast throughout the body when it comes to the endocrine system. So the neuron at the top is releasing neurotransmitters because the action potential is being created, or the chain of action potentials, really, which is what the nerve impulse is. So in response to that, in response to the inflow of calcium, there are neurotransmitters released. They're released only onto those cells. That's what makes it local. An endocrine gland, on the other hand, releases its hormone into a capillary bed. So the nearby cells, the cells that are directly receiving those signals, are really just the cells that make up the wall of a capillary. And it passes through spaces between those cells making up those capillary walls so that the hormones get put into the bloodstream. Once they're in the bloodstream, the general circulation, then they're going to be swept around the whole body. And you should appreciate that it doesn't take many of these things in the blood to actually have a profound effect. Hormones are impressively strong in their effect because the signal is going to be amplified. That's something I'm going to talk about in a little bit. But what I'm saying here is that if you measure what the concentration of a given hormone is in the blood, it would be, you know, in terms of like food, it would be negligible. You wouldn't even know it's there. But just those few molecules in the blood can have a profound effect if they reach a receptor molecule somewhere. And they will if they're in the blood, because they're going to end up going everywhere. Okay. Let me see if I... Oh, I don't have a picture. So while we're still here, let me give you a couple more definitions. We've been using the word hormone. That is a functional classification of a chemical signal. It's a hormone if it's put into the bloodstream. Now, we just use the word hormone by itself if the thing that produced it is an endocrine gland. Okay? But there are some hormones that are put into the bloodstream by neurons. And this is what a neurohormone is. So neurohormones are released exocytotically from the end of an axon, just like a neurotransmitter is. But instead of serving just to affect that immediate cell, a neurohormone is put into a capillary bed, and it takes a ride throughout the whole body, just like it would if it were from an endocrine gland. So the only distinction there between neurohormone and regular hormone is that a neurohormone is actually produced by the nervous system, whereas a hormone is produced by the endocrine system. We can get more specific than that, though, as well. We usually use the word hormone to refer to something that actually does get sent all the way through the body. But there are some chemical signals that are released by endocrine organs, or endocrine tissue at least, endocrine cells, that actually don't get taken up by the bloodstream. Instead, they have a local effect, a comparatively local effect. And so we have two more words we can use to describe these things: paracrine signal and autocrine signal. Now, endocrine, paracrine, and autocrine all have that crine ending, right? So they're operating as chemical signals, all of them. They all share the fact that they're released by endocrine cells, which are either well-formed organs like we looked at in the previous slide, or like I said, patches of tissue in other organs, in other systems. But what makes the distinction here is that a paracrine signal is released by some type of cell into the interstitium, not into the bloodstream, just into the extracellular fluid. And it diffuses some short distance and has an effect on a nearby cell. All right? So the distinction there is that it's unlike a hormone, it's not broadcast. It works more locally, but it's not released by a neuron, it's released by an endocrine cell. The third one, autocrine, what does that tell you? What does auto mean? Self. So an autocrine signal is a signal that's released by a cell and that actually affects that same cell or another cell just like it, right by it. The same type of cell. So that's also local. The difference between para and auto, though, is that a paracrine signal affects a different kind of cell nearby. An autocrine signal affects the same kind of cell. Okay, I just wanted to make that distinction because I was thinking I had a picture, but I guess I didn't. Table 17.2, or I should say slide 4. I'm not going to read this to you, but I'm just showing you. This is not an exhaustive list of hormones by any means. In fact, we're always discovering more hormones. But these are the big players, and we're going to, in this chapter, look at the action of almost all of these. This is here just kind of as a reference for you. Notice that each one has an abbreviation, and it's at least for the sake of reading about these things, it's sometimes good to learn these abbreviations. I'm not going to test you on the abbreviations, but it's good if you can learn what these mean, because then you can read them in sentences and know what you're talking about. I mean, when you read CRH, you should be saying in your mind to yourself, corticotropin releasing hormone, and so on. Okay, now let's go to 5 and talk more about the pituitary I was talking about. I already told you that the pituitary is really two structures in one of which is glandular and one of which is not. Where do we find the pituitary? Well, you should remember from 201 dissection that it's hanging down from the bottom of the brain, right? Looks like a little grape hanging from a stalk. What do we call that stalk that joins the pituitary with the brain? The hint is that it's a funnel-shaped stalk. What's the word that means funnel? These gaps are always uninteresting to listen to when you're going back through the recordings. Infundibulum. All right, so the infundibulum, which is labeled as the pituitary stalk here, that's the slender part that joins the pituitary with the brain above it. But there are, like I keep saying, two distinct parts to the pituitary, and they have obviously different names from each other, but they also have multiple names each. All right, the pituitary as an overall structure, which means both of pieces combined, also has an alternative name. You can call it the pituitary, but you can also call it the hypothesis. Not hypothesis, as in the scientific method, not a TH, a PH. Hypophysis, PHYSIS, hypothesis. So hypothesis is just interchangeable with pituitary. That's what it means. It literally means the growth below. Hypo meaning under, right? So now to the two different parts. One of them is called the anterior pituitary. Obviously, that's the one that's in the front, right? The part behind that is the posterior pituitary. Those are one name for each of those two parts. But there's an all, just like a pituitary can be called a hypothesis, the anterior pituitary has an additional name. The other name for the anterior pituitary is the adenohypothesis. A-D-E-N-O hypothesis, all one word. Now, what does the adeno combining form mean? Anyone know? Adeno means gland. So the adeno hypothesis, or alternatively the anterior pituitary, is the only part of the pituitary that's really a gland, even though we usually call the whole thing the pituitary gland. Okay, so it's glandular. In other words, it's made up of endocrine cells. The posterior pituitary, which is not glands, a glandular tissue, it has the alternative name of neurohypophysis. And that's a good descriptor because the neurohypophysis, or posterior pituitary, is really just an extension of the hypothalamus. All right? The hypothalamus is part of the brain officially, right? And there are nuclei in the hypothalamus. What are nuclei? They are cell bodies, a group of cell bodies occurring in the central nervous system, right? That's what a nucleus is, as opposed to a ganglion, which would be the same thing occurring in the peripheral nervous system, right? So there are nuclei in the hypothalamus. Well, those cell bodies that make up those nuclei, those aren't the entire neuron, right? Those are just the cell bodies. Emanating from the cell bodies are axons. Those axons together make up a tract, right? That's what a tract is, group of axons in the central nervous system. Those axons lead somewhere. They're cabled together in a tract that forms part of this infundibulum. The posterior part of this infundibulum is made up of axons. Those axons travel all the way down and make up the posterior pituitary. And they, of course, end in axon terminals, like any axon does. And so that's why this posterior pituitary, or neurohypothesis, is not glandular, it's neural. That's why it's called the neurohypothesis. All right? So the chemical signals that are released from the posterior pituitary would be classified as what kind of chemicals, based on what definitions I've given you? What kind of signals would those be? If neurohormones. They are neurohormones. Now, they're not neurotransmitters because they don't have a local effect. When they're released from the posterior pituitary, they're released into the bloodstream, but they're being released by axons. So they're neurohormones. All right? In other words, the posterior pituitary, or neurohypophysis, is really just an extension of the hypothalamus. It's just the ends of those same neurons that started out in the hypothalamus. All right? While I'm still on this slide, let me say that not only are these two parts of the hypothesis distinct, I mean, you can actually see that they, histologically, you can tell them apart. But they, like I said earlier, develop from totally different parts. They just happen to grow together, but they have totally different origins developmentally. What you're seeing here is that the adeno hypothesis, the front part, that, I don't know how well it illustrates this, but the adeno hypothesis develops from the roof of the mouth, whereas the neurohypothesis develops from the brain, of course. It's technically part of the brain. Now, back to this stalk. Let me see what the next slide is. I can't remember. Okay. Let's go on to slide six. Or actually, do we have to stop already? Man, I hate these 50-minute. All right, we'll stop there.